You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Now, if you haven't had the opportunity to stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and talk with a battery specialist, you need to do that, because these guys are very knowledgeable about every kind of battery, hence the name Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera to your rangefinder, any battery that you need, these guys can help you find. Even if it's a specific, unique, one-off battery, these guys can help you find what you need. If you want to find out more information on Interstate Batteries, about their brand, about their history, about the company in general, and all the batteries they offer, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Sure. Let's do this thing.
There we go. All right, guys. Welcome back. Man, it's going to be a fun one today. 281, 10 points of edge feathering.
Man, this is just a let loose kind of kick back, reflect on some of January, because January is a very important month for a lot of deer hunters and or land managers. Seasons still are open in several states, but a lot of seasons have closed. So we're in this, like, some people are just heavy after the habitat improvements, while other people are trying to still kill a deer.
Yeah. Yep. You know, you can kind of test the temperature, if you will, on social media world when you see how many times we get tagged by people out doing habitat work versus hunting.
Yep.
And right now it's full-fledged habitat. And I think most people that listen to this podcast are probably pretty into habitat management if they've sat through our hours and sermons and all that stuff that people want to call it. And so, I'm happy that you guys are here once again. You know, 2020 was a great year for us, not to get too off topic, but we continue to grow with our audience and people that are listening. And, you know, it's a great time in a world that's kind of doom and gloom. It seems like a lot of people are down in the dumps, and even in the world of habitat management with declining species and different things, you know, it should be refreshing, though, to know that, and we're here to encourage you guys and help you guys avoid costly mistakes or mistakes that cost you a lot of time. And really, guys, we hear so many positive things from clients and listeners that it's just so encouraging to us to know that there is a group of people out there that are really doing some amazing work, whether it's a client or a listener, that have done some things that's just overall just doggone it. It's exciting and should be a major encouragement for all of us.
And to, I guess, address that a little bit further, not everyone, even though people are having success, there's a lot of people out there. Maybe this is the first time you're listening, or you're beginning to learn about all the things that you can do to improve stuff. You're sitting in a position where you're like, I'm not happy. I'm not satisfied with the property and what it's producing. I don't know what I don't know, and I'm just kind of downright frustrated. You welcome to a community that is about knowledge and education, and then empowering you to go and actively manage a property and its resources, not sit back and hope that next year's better, or next year my neighbors won't do X and shoot small bucks. Like, we're here to talk about ways that you can control your property, make it better. And there's a lot of people out there who listen, who are utilizing these techniques, especially the one right now we're going to talk about today, but utilizing these techniques and sharing some incredible results along their way, their journey. That's fun to be a part of.
Absolutely. And so I'm going to share a recent text I got from a client this week. Sent me a picture of a beautiful bobwhite quail in his hand, and he said, on my own farm. That's how he started, on my own farm. So there's a pride aspect to doing stuff on your own farm, and almost like a big garden where you get to manipulate and do things. And when nature flourishes.
When you're eating vine-ripe tomatoes that you grew?
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
So he says, on my own farm, deer have been bedding all over me since we did the TSI and the bedding thickets. We jump deer all over the place. At least four coveys live on us also, along with a big group of turkeys roosting in the middle of the place. I appreciate all you guys have helped me with. I have more work to do on the bedding, but things are looking good.
That's awesome.
And, you know, so TSI on his forest, I think, I'm trying to remember, I think it was 160 acres. And so it's mostly crop or warm season pasture. So he's got a lot of, like, open ground that's not real habitat area or
you wouldn't
areas
see, you wouldn't expect deer bedding in it frequently.
Or quail are in it, or turkeys are in it on a regular basis. Now they are in the crop fields, but the thing about it is he's doing TSI in the timber, but he's also got bedding hot spots. He's got some edge feathering to do, some invasive species removal, but overall the guy's already seeing four coveys on 160 acres, that's pretty good. That tells us the habitat's already, you know, it's not bad.
Four coveys. I mean, if that's an average of 10 bird covey, that's 40 birds.
Yeah.
You can grow bird populations off that.
I mean, and that came the same day I had a conversation with another client that is really getting in. A guy I visited with this past spring, so I can't take credit for all this, but I am very motivated for the fact that he's already seen this. I visited with him. I think it was April. It was right in the middle of all the lockdown stuff, and we were unsure about pretty well slid in under
late April. Yeah,
yeah, just slid out there real quick and came back, and he had 30 or 40 pheasants living on him, and having multiple coveys of quail. And
you're saying now?
Now,
right?
Now,
not then. Now,
where the area that he's got is got a lot of old rank CRP, so he's going to actually get some grazing in there to really try to add some disturbance, knock down the rank grass, but remove a bunch of smooth brome, maybe add a few acres of a Milo food plot to try to hold all the birds on him more. And but overall, like, that guy's already getting the plan, getting the mindset of going, okay, unlike a lot of us who are singing the blues, going, I just hope to hear a bobwhite quail whistle again.
Yeah.
He's got him with the fear of going, I don't want what's happening out east.
Yeah.
So he's trying to capitalize and turn that ship before it ever really even starts where he's at. So
I got one yesterday, a text message from a client. They were breaking up. You've been there, down in southern Oklahoma, breaking out big Bermuda pastures. It's a weird mix of Bermuda and then some natives, but basically had him initially start with creating corridors. He sprayed them out last growing season, got some flush of annual weeds and everything coming back, and then kind of going into year two of removal of Bermuda in those corridors. But he's like, hey, I don't have the dormant season disc. Guess why? The hawks came and are working those corridors and rooting around in the corridors.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So he's like, kind of a good thing, but kind of a bad thing. He goes, I've got a late season hunting opportunity. His son was successful in tagging a couple hogs, but they're following these corridors and going right up them, rooting around. So it's like, hey.
So it's like once they removed the Bermuda and that had died back, the hogs could actually get into the dirt and root around.
They're finding something there that is pretty concentrated to those areas of corridors. So it would be interesting, again, to see that flush come back next year, grow back up, and create these corridors across a big, wide-open pasture.
Interesting.
But just being able to take note and see that, like, when things change from the norm, whatever your norm is in your area, generally speaking, you apply good, sound habitat management principles or techniques.
Norm is probably bad.
Exactly. That's the point. Norm is bad in most cases. So you do something different, wildlife are going to react to them probably in a positive way.
Yeah.
And that's so refreshing. And we were at, I guess I was at a property in Texas the other day, and that gentleman, he was doing some fantastic things, but still wanted some more structure and long-term planning. But what he had done so far, even though the long-term connectivity of the property, let's say, wasn't there, he was still sticking to sound natural resource management practices, and he was seeing an incredible response from the local wildlife there too. And it just goes to show, stick with things that make sense. And even if you don't have all your I's dotted and your T's crossed and whatnot on a plan or a focus for the future, if you do good things, likely it will yield good results. Even if it's maybe a little disconnected from this one woodblock to the next, like, start with the practice and go from there. Like, once you see how wildlife react, it'll probably, like, you know, click some light bulbs off in your head and be like, oh, yeah, I'll just extend this.
Yeah.
Or I'll just connect
and
this.
And that's kind of the hope with today's topic is or bedding thickets or these micro clear cuts or invasive species removals, that once you get a landowner, it's almost like a – Once that shark tastes blood or smells it, they just want more of it. And a landowner experiences the benefits of a of TSI and they see the wildlife utilize it, it's like, oh, I'm doing everything now.
Like, and I'm sold.
And I think a lot of times that when clients of ours go into we visit with them and then they get the report and the maps, they go in and start doing the work. There's probably a little bit of a hesitation, and they're going, Is this really as good as they make it sound? Is this really going to change from now to next deer season like they said it would? Is this really going to bring back quail, or is this really going to steer the deer? And, I mean, I'd put my name on it. I'd take it.
Yeah.
I'd say, if you do the plan, I can guarantee you you're going to see a change. Guarantee it.
Promise for positive results to come from – executing the plan.
Absolutely.
Are you going to accomplish and kill 160 inch deer every single year? Well, I can't guarantee that, but I can guarantee that the deer will positively respond. You'll probably have more activity. You will probably have better quality herd if you, again, follow all the recommendations. But I can't promise a 160 is going to be there every year.
No.
But the wildlife will respond in a healthier way.
Absolutely. And I think that's where
I'll take that to the bank.
I mean, how many times have we had, but the bedding thickets are the main thing where people are like, whoa, they reacted. Can I go make more of these? Where should I make more of these?
Can I expand them?
Is it going to be, it's like, yeah, sure, you can do that. Just know that if, and that's why we don't like even the bedding or food plots to be bigger than 4 acres, because then it gets harder to define and have defined bedding or defined feeding.
Well, and that's a good point of, hey, I know you experienced, kind of had to share this with some folks, I know you've experienced some fantastic results from these bedding thickets, but don't worship the bedding thicket. Know that there's a lot of other techniques out there that you need to still be doing that will complement what you've done already in a bedding thicket. So, you know, take that regeneration and that cover and now just come out, extend from it, and do the medium TSI like recommended.
Yeah.
And now your entire wood block is extremely valuable. But that compared with your bedding thicket, huge results. But it doesn't mean that you need to say, I just cut in 2 acres, 4 will make it better.
Yeah,
No, that's not how
I would
how
rather
works.
Have 2 2-acre bedding thickets than 1 5-acre bedding thicket.
Yeah.
Or 1 6-acre bedding thicket, for the simple fact that it's easier to congregate them or define where they're at, and it's easier to make them move from one to the other. What we don't want is deer to be in a thick cover or thicket.
We want,
I can't even get in there to hunt them.
I want daylight activity in an area that I can access.
Yeah.
And that usually means limiting those type of cuts, depending on the topography, the area, everything, to below 3 acres.
Absolutely. And I know that anybody who's been on a farm, one of our farms, one of our clients' farms, where there's been an appropriate amount of bedding thickets with edge feathering, with food plots laid out, with access in a how do I say this? If somebody's been in that situation or have hunted a farm like that, it's almost like, this is, I've never seen something like this. I've never experienced something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can access my farm and I can hunt on a spot where I feel like my morning activity is amazing because they're around these thickets. Or in the evening, I've got deer on camera moving during daylight because
I loop
how many clients
around the food.
Do we talk to that have like limited days to be out there but high success?
Yep.
Where it's like, I killed a doe with my son, I killed a couple of bucks, or my dad killed a buck and I killed a buck, and I really didn't hunt as much as I used to.
Yeah.
Well, voila, look at that. Yeah. There goes some geese right there.
Look at that. I like that.
I was sitting inside this morning and looked outside, and while I'm inside my house, of course, that big half-circle window in my living room, I saw like 7 geese fly right over the treetops.
Oh,
I was looking for
weird.
My daughter to try to tell her, but they were gone in a flash. I mean, that happens all the time. That happens for us. And our farms aren't even managed to the extent that they should because our time is so limited.
We're
consulting everywhere.
I don't know. I guess there's with January being a month full of information being out there, and a lot of people experiencing or doing habitat management projects, just want to reinforce, do the projects that make sense and will yield results. Like what we're going to talk about today, edge feathering, you can't buy it. It's not a product. Like it is just, you're creating habitat. You're not focusing on time doing piddly stuff. Like it's impactful.
Yep.
And that's where we want to encourage people. Because again, go back and listen to podcasts from clients or people who are putting this stuff into practice and hear it straight from the horse's mouth. You know, they're the ones who are seeing the results that we're talking about, and providing tons of examples for sound practices with great results.
Absolutely. Before we jump into it, notice that you're wearing, we did cover this in the fall and a little bit, we covered it pre-fall, so like August or September. Now we're covering it, and then we covered it a little bit during the fall, but it's totally unrelated to edge feathering. But you're wearing the Danner Recurves, and I'm wearing the LaCrosse Lodestar. Something like that. Overall, and the only reason we're covering this is because we wear boots almost every single day unless we're in our house still working. But what's your opinion of the Recurve?
Love them. You can see they're pretty worn.
Yeah.
Like not like deteriorated, but just worn, broken.
You can tell the leather has been through some briars.
It's been around.
Have you treated them yet at all?
No treatment of waterproofing, additional things. This is straight factory put on, laced up, done. And they've had a lot of miles on them.
You never hunted in them. You hunted in the LaCrosse.
Yes.
I can honestly say, I think the Recurves are my favorite boot out of the box that I've ever worn.
No, I do not disagree with that at all.
Extremely comfortable. They're broke in as soon as you get them.
Yep.
My biggest complaint might be the downfall of that boot is the fact that I don't think they're as durable as I would like. Don't think they're going to last me as an everyday boot. They're going to last me 2 years based on what I've seen so far.
So basically, you're saying probably a trade-off between out-of-the-box, ready, broken, comfortable, flexible, got give to it, not super stiff leather that's going to last you a little bit longer.
Lightweight.
You're feeling,
yeah.
Right. Lighter weight boot. I could see that.
I noticed that mine, just like the pronghorn, the leather seems to be a little bit soft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think if you're down south and you got a lot of green briars, you're going to wear them out pretty not quick, but because we got to, you know, as we say too, we wear out boots probably quicker than a lot of people because we're out in briars almost every single day, at least multiple times a week. We're in some sort of vegetation. So
vegetation, but not only that, but just miles on slopes, and you're shifting around, you're putting wear on different parts of the sole that doesn't necessarily get it, and they're well used, but I mean, every time I do put my foot in it, it's like, there's some boots, and I've worn plenty where I was like, dadgummit, like you put your foot in there and you're just like, you're a little disappointed. You're like, I really got to lace it up. Like, here we go. Here's a day with my foot in the boot. I'm not looking forward to it.
Yeah.
But that's not the case with these overall. They're very comfortable. What's
I feel like, you know, since we started Land and Legacy in 2017, I think I've gone through four pairs of boots. So I've gone through, and that's four pairs of every day. I wear some other boots for, like, I try to wear a certain boot when I'm chainsawing. I try to wear a certain boot when I'm hunting, or I do. But consulting everyday use real estate, I've gone through four different pairs of boots, and the recurve is my favorite ever my whole life.
My whole life, man.
But I'm just not sure it's going to last me as long as I would like. I'm wearing the LaCrosse, and they, out of the box, stiffer, take a little bit of break-in period. I think these will last longer than the LaCrosse recurve. But I would. I'm sitting here in these LaCrosse boots right now, wishing I was in my recurves. But I don't want to wear my recurves out like crazy.
Yeah. They're, the Lodestar has a more rigid sole, certainly, on it, I think. That would be a, I look at it, I'm like, that would be a great hiking shoe. But I just like, if I'm out and I don't know necessarily exactly what I'm going to get into, I like a taller boot that really goes above the ankle that much more, just for that stability of moving in, let's say, unknown terrain that I might get myself into. But
yeah,
that's just a personal preference, let's say.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so you ready to jump in and start going through? We have 10 things about edge feathering to help you guys in your decisions, or just key points. And and we say this because we're seeing a lot of people in the social media world post and are doing edge feathering. Mm-hmm. It's great. It almost feels like it's a new strategy.
Hey, if someone wants to say it's a fad, I hope it's a fad that just is everlasting. You know, this is you know, a phenomenal thing to get yourself on board. And if you don't know what edge feathering is, sit back. We're going to explain it here this week, but we're also going to direct you to YouTube, where you've got videos on there. A couple videos on edge feathering, and we've gone back and shown results. And if you need other pictures of it too, check out social media, as there's lots of pictures on Instagram or Facebook that we've shared edge feathering, kind of before after results.
You know, you talk to various people, and there's all kinds of consulting out there and videos or people that are putting out content to improve habitat for wildlife, but it almost seems like the two main things that I hear people stick with us as Land and Legacy, they stick edge feathering and bedding thickets with us. That's like, and natives. Those are our things.
Yep.
It's like, we didn't come up with the idea of edge feathering. We didn't come up with the idea of bedding thickets. We just came up with the idea of using a habitat enhancement tool, project, practice, that has been around for years, and used it in a way to make the hunting better.
I think of the origin of these things. Right, we didn't create it. We simply said, this is from a wildlife standpoint, and this is, I think, the difference from let's say, us to maybe others out there. We looked at what plant communities would grow and respond after that work is done, and then how the wildlife are going to react to that. Therefore, when they're going to use it and how it needs to be spaced or laid out across a property. It is based on the plant communities and the vegetation that will respond with these techniques. That's first and foremost what we witnessed, and then we just put a name to it. Edge feathering, but that's been around for a long time.
There's a lot of government, even in the government sector, where with cost share opportunities, there's edge feathering projects.
Even the
government knows it's great, and they screw up everything.
That was not political at all.
It doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican. Governments, they always screw it up. And anyway, and then you go bedding thickets, which they call it temporary forest openings.
Yeah.
In the government. Like, there's cost share opportunities for temporary forest openings. And basically, they're just micro clear cuts.
Yep.
And that's what, you know, we use those. And they're not only beneficial to deer, but so many other species. So we'll cover that today. But
yeah,
there seems to be a lot of people that are starting edge feather, which is so awesome. I love it. It feels like an old tool that's coming back. It's like an old school.
Right?
Yeah. It's retro land management is edge feathering.
But truthfully it is, right? I mean, the whole point of edge feathering, I know we'll talk about it in a couple different points, is creating the transitional edge between an opening and then more mature, older timber. And so we are creating it. It's bringing it back. It's that retro thing. But It's doing it in a mechanical mean.
20 years from now, if land management is still, people are still really into it, which I'm sure they will be, given Jesus isn't back here by then. But,
correct.
20 years from now, I feel like edge feathering is one of those practices where every cycle will come back going, maybe we shouldn't have got away from edge feathering. Maybe we shouldn't focus on some other fad that came out or some other product that came back. It's just like every 10 years we're going to circle back and say, we should probably still stick to edge feathering. And we went through all those others, but we forgot about edge feathering.
That's why I love the different techniques that we will recommend or use ourselves is the timeless capabilities of them, right? If we didn't create anything, then that means it's timeless, right?
Yep.
It's something that just, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to embrace that because that means that realizing, hey, God did it right when he created it. We just need to get it back to that point. So these techniques are going to get it back to timeless plant communities on a landscape that make an impact for wildlife. And I know that sounds way above and beyond when we're trying to discuss edge feathering, but if you don't have the backstory, the foundation of what it actually is, then you may not grasp how important it is.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of people are doing edge feathering now because it's like, okay, I did my food plots, and now I'm going to step out beyond.
Make my food plots better.
Yeah. I either need to make my food plots better, or they said get in your timber, and I took one step out of my food plot, and I'm here, so let me work on the edge. And it's a stepping stone, if you will, outside of or going beyond what a lot of people will focus on for land management, and that's the food plot. So we're getting out of that. We're going into the edge. And there are 10 big reasons why you should be using that. And we're going to talk about them right now. What do we have number one?
Number one, for all you deer hunters that maybe not be into the natives as much as some of us and the quail guys that listen. Number one is steering deer. How many times have you set on a food plot that's bigger than a half acre and you've complained or thought, man, they're always on that other end,
whether it's a road or a wind, you just can't get there.
You just can't get there, and you're like, I need to just walk through it early in the afternoon and get to that back end, and set up there. Well, then you still have the opportunity for them to come out and be on the end you were hunting. Like, you just don't have any way to really steer them or know that they're going to be in a certain place.
So I love the ability basically to go and say on a food plot with a hard edge, go and say, I'm hunting here, here's all my observations, and instead of allowing that to continue to happen and wish that something they're just gonna automatically change where they come out, I'm gonna force them. I'm gonna say, you're actually gonna now come out here. Because when I went and I mechanically cut the edge, the trees, I'm literally dropping trees along the edge of the food plot, I'm laying them in a fashion, I'm felling them in a direction that is essentially, once it grows up and everything, a living edge. It's like a boundary, a barrier along the edge, and it's going to force them out closer to a tree stand where you have deer coming out. We've termed or utilized in management plans open edge feathering or closed edge feathering. Closed is literally just laying them down.
Purposeful felling.
Purposefully laying them perpendicular to the food plot. Parallel to the food plot, so that blocks them, where open is perpendicular and they can kind of walk through, let's say, and they've got a tree trunk on both sides and they're walking through. It's an open lane.
I basically have started telling landowners, just so they can kind of understand, is like closed edge feathering is cutting them, and either if they're leaning out, because a lot of times if it's an older field, they're leaning. So you basically cut them and then push them kind of to where they line up.
It's like a 45 almost, degree pivot.
Yeah. You just spin them around, push them with the tractor, whatever it may be. But open edge feathering hopefully is in an area that, like, you can take that first 20 yards and just drop the trees and let them fall the way they want. to where deer can still move through them very freely, but you still get that major benefit to everything else we'll talk about.
Yeah, and so steering, there is one thing when we're on that point. Don't make it so narrow that deer aren't going to want to walk through it. You have to give open edge feathering, quite 20 to 30 yards wide, so they just will routinely do it and do it comfortably. Everyone's seen, basically, you think of like a dozer deck when a food plot gets cleared, it gets slammed up against the edge of the timber, and it's just left to deteriorate or whatever. That essentially is a form of closed edge feathering because everything is just laid up there and they work around it. They don't go through it.
And it's so dense. And I think that's why a lot of people have a negative connotation with edge feathering is because they picture a dozer deck on the side of a field that every groundhog or coyote den or
that
just
that's
not very
piled up mess. That's not what we're creating.
No.
We're creating an open, like movable, navigable way for deer and other game to be able to come in and out of food plot, but just do it in a controlled fashion that makes it accessible for you. So there's hunting benefit.
Yep.
Just steering deer, period, point one, is the ability to make deer come out and go back into the timber and where you want them to.
And the thing about it is you don't have to do the whole edge. Like if you have defined bedding, let's say you've got 250 yards off the food plot, you've got a 1 acre clear cut, a bedding thicket, and you know that's where the deer are most likely coming from, but that's kind of catty corner to the food plot to where it's not a straight east to west line. Maybe it's a little bit southwest of the food plot. Well, if you edge feather that first 50 yards, there's a pretty good chance they're going to swing low and make that path of least resistance and make it a closer walk than rather walking all the way up and around. And if you've laid it out appropriately, and when I say all the way around, I mean walk to the northwest and come in on the northwest side of the food plot. Because if you're hunting it appropriately, you're probably hunting with a northwest or a west wind or to where it's making it an easier path, a path of least resistance, and it's a shorter distance, but also the wind's more in their favor. I mean, it's like,
honestly, when
easy
in an appropriate laid-out property, when a deer gets up from its bed, that is hopefully we're bedding where you want them, right? I know where they're going to come into the field at.
Yeah.
Like let's just say it's 4 o'clock, and you're like, okay, deer are probably getting on their feet. I know where they're going to walk out at. Because I've appropriately edge feathered a field edge, and I'm utilizing that
and
strictly
I have
for the strictly I, for the like I, again, if you're the deer hunter, you don't give a rip about plant communities and stuff like that. Still do this, still do it, because it's going to help you with your habitat and
absolutely
and hunting,
absolutely, and I think that's the big thing about. Just edge. It is one of those things, and I hope it is I hope it catches on like hinge cutting, because I know if people start edge feathering, of course they're going to be like, whoa, this is it's different.
Sure.
For somebody who's watched nothing but outdoor television, it's very different than what they've probably seen, and I can't think of a single outdoor television show where edge feathering has been done to where they're setting on a food plot and it's like, whoa, they edge feathered that. I don't see it.
None of them have done it. No.
At least that they have. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So my apologies if you have, but they just don't do it.
No.
And I think probably part of that is because, 20 yards along the edge of the food plot doesn't seem like a make or break deal. But in the grand scheme of things, it's incredibly beneficial.
The other aspect is a lot of people may not be hunting a food plot that is over half an acre, unless you're in a crop field. But my gosh, this is a perfect opportunity to say go to a farmer and say, hey, I want to help you along your field edges. Can I help you cut some trees back? And we'll get into the benefits there later on. But you can do it on a crop field too. And just say, you know what? Hey, we're going to take this 100-acre crop field. I'm going to edge feather some pockets. I'm going to steer some deer. So bow hunting this thing isn't so dadgum difficult.
Yeah. And I think if you're in a crop field and you've done like a CP38 program where you've got 30 yards of pollinators around that field and then you edge feather,
you
look out.
Yeah. We'll talk about. Yeah. Well, turkey poults, the amount of other game that can benefit from this technique is really incredible. Yeah. So what's
number
what's
two? Visibility two? Barrier, two parts.
Yes.
So big thing being what's incredibly beneficial from a hunting strategy, or I guess both of them are, but one is when you're in your tree stand or blind and you've got an edge feathered, an edge that's been feathered, and you're high enough that once you've cut those trees, let's say, you know, regrowth is 10 foot tall, you can still, and you're up 15, 20 foot, you can see over that edge.
So you can see if
there's deer on the other side. Let's just say you're on an edge, you're on the food plot edge that runs east to west, and on the north to south line, you can see it's been edge feathered, and you can see 100 yards over and see that there's a buck he's working that edge. But because of edge feathering, he can't really see out into the food plot real well. So if you do grunt, you do call, he most likely has to come into the food plot to make sure of the fact that there's not a deer in there.
He can't grow wings like the Red Bull commercial and flutter up and look and see. He literally has to come through where you edge feathered openly and give you that
or
shot opportunity.
Or come around on the side that's been closed edge feathered. So either way, he has to come into the food plot to really get a good look at what's going on. And unlike other times where if it's not been edge feathered and you see him in the timber and you grunt, he can look out there and be like, I don't see a deer in that food plot.
I would say that's stupid. 98% of food plots, if people are trying to call from them, if a deer is in the timber, just, and this is, again, like how bad habitat generally is that we see and the most hunters are hunting in, but 98% of them, a deer in a calling situation would be able to see from interior of the timber across an entire food plot.
Yeah.
That isn't ideal from a hunting standpoint and a calling standpoint. Block the visual down low and make them commit to come and give you that shot opportunity.
Yeah. The other one would be, let's just use that analogy of your setup on the east to west line and the north to south line is just 50 yards away from you. And let's say deer are out in the food plot and it's dark now and you know that deer have kind of moved over to the other edge of the food plot. If you've edge feathered in front of your stand or in front of your blind, you basically have a screen to block you as you can enter or exit the food plot. Mm-hmm. Most of the time it's exit. You don't typically hunt your food plots in the mornings. At least we don't, and don't really advise it a lot because it doesn't really fit in our strategy. But you can slip down after dark and get out of there and have a lot more barrier or structure to block you as you leave. So that's a huge one.
It definitely is.
Number three, improved food plot edge.
Every time, wherever we go, we either see trees left in food plots or the edges of small food plots just
even big not, ones if the trees are
that's
big.
That's true, yeah. But just the food plot edges are just always inferior. Like the growth is always poor.
That's always mediocre.
That's where deer always come out, start browsing. But that's not the point. The point is the competition between sunlight, nutrients, and moisture with the bigger trees right adjacent to the edge.
Yep.
And so edge
under
feathering,
the drip line.
Yeah. Edge feathering will terminate those trees, or lay them over if you're felling them or treating them, and it will open up the opportunity to reduce that competition, get more sunlight, and the annual weeds and everything that come back in along the edge that you cut are not going to be blocking or robbing as much nutrients. They're not going to have that root system that the trees had. Therefore, the edge of a food plot will not be mediocre. You can know that, hey, when I have this acre opening, I'm actually not just having good forage in 3/4 of an acre. I have good forage in the full acre. And you're telling me that I can steer deer and make the hunting better? I don't understand why some people haven't adopted this, knowing, too, that my food plot is going to be improved. I'm fertilizing that edge, so I might as well try and get the most forage out of it.
Yeah.
So I need to feather the edge. I need to do that.
Yeah. And a lot of times, I think fall food plots are way more popular than spring food plots.
Mm-hmm.
And that competition on the edge is way more severe with fall plantings as it is spring plantings. So that's why a lot of times you don't see big turnip bulbs or radishes right up under the drip line, because here in the Midwest, August, September is now probably our hottest and driest months, or it has been the last 4 years. And we usually base on a five-year cycle of trying to pick what's been more beneficial. We say, let's look at the last 5 years. And right now, the last 4 years, September's been the driest month of the year. And so if that's the case, you can forget about having quality food plots under the drip line or on the edge of the food plot. So you might as well make it, instead of being a mediocre food plot, make it a phenomenal edge.
Yeah, absolutely. Knowing the rest of the benefits, make it a great edge and reduce food plot competition. Because, again, you're putting just as much money to the edge of those food plots as you are the interior, but you're not getting the same return out of them.
Yeah.
From a forage base. So cut the edge. And it's literally that simple.
Yep.
Cut it.
Number four. Woody browse during the winter. So a lot of times, and this is why we'll prioritize, or when we talk about prioritizing your projects, and if you're a landowner who, you know, you bought the farm a couple years ago, the first thing you did was food plots and then some trails, and outside of that, you haven't really done anything else. If you go from food plots as your number one thing that you put your time and money into, and then number two being edge feathering, you would likely see deer bedding right off the food plot in that dense cover from your edge feathering. And that's one of the problems, or one of the big questions we get with it. And so if you're prioritizing your projects, we would probably say bedding thickets or good cover, old field management. Try to improve your cover and your bedding areas first, and then do edge feathering. But if you're one of those landowners who have done that, now you're trying to edge feather, think about it from this standpoint of, we're just trying to always maximize our acres and put more food on the ground for more months out of the year. And woody browse is one of those things that is food almost every single month of the year. They're browsing on something, regardless of how great your food plots are. And so the more acres of browse that you can add, the more deer you can hold, the healthier your deer are. And then obviously with edge feathering, the more cover that's available. So anytime you increase woody browse, you increase food and cover. And so during the winter months, typically we're trying to feed our deer during the most stressful time of the year for a lot of us. If you're down south, it's the middle of summer, but Midwest and north is probably late winter, early spring. And so if you edge feather, you may see them browsing a little bit on the edge feathered areas, but that's probably peak performance time for your food plots. So they're probably going to take the ice cream plants and go with the easier food that's available and go with your food plot. But as that food plot starts to get browse or kind of go a little bit dormant or get snow on it, that's when you'll see them really start working over your edge feathered areas. And that's when you just got way more food available. So
I think, and we haven't necessarily hit it as much or have it in this point. However, it is still definitely goes into the hunting technique of thing. But when you do have ample woody browse on the edge, the amount of daylight activity that you will experience in that food plot is definitely greater, because as deer get up from bedding interior of the woods, they come to the edge where it has grown up, provides a lot of protection from them, because that's what the plant communities around there do. It's 5, 6, 7 foot tall, but that means there's food available and accessible, and they're going to be browsing on that along the edge rather than staging deeper into the timber and then coming out at last light. They come to the edge, feed there because they have the cover still, the food, and then they're going to come into. But most times, again, we talked about earlier, you can shoot into this edge feathering. You can create the shot opportunities, so you're improving the amount of food forage in those acres around your food plot. And it's native food, natural. They need it many, many months out of the year. Lots of woody browse there along the edge.
Yeah, number five, rabbitat. And we say rabbitat, that's a common term, but we're talking rodent, small game habitat, specifically rabbits, rats, mice, those things that
someone's
are.
Someone's sitting there thinking,
why do I give
in
a.
The world do I care about,
care
that?
About that? And so, you know, if you've listened a couple podcasts back, Steel Before Steel, you don't hear us really advocate for trapping hardcore when habitat is so poor. I'll prioritize, and again, let's fix the habitat long before we start breaking the traps out. Because we can make a lot more gain long term than we can
gain.
We can make more gain with a chainsaw than we can trapping long term.
Gain and game through this habitat, right? So we create shrubby cover, we create this edge. That is a lot of opportunities for the rodents and the rabbits to be able to come live there on a routine basis.
Yep.
And you can guarantee that, sure, if I have that, there's going to be some.
That's probably those same ones I saw. The geese just.
Yeah, the same flock flew over.
Flew right over.
But you're going to have those opportunities for small game. And a lot of people, just outside of just knowing that it's there and to kind of feed the predators that are around, you can also hunt them. Like, that is another opportunity. I'm seeing a lot of people, a lot of the family getting them out outside of season, whether they're shed hunting or they're just trying to go and hunt and jump up some rabbits, or they know a guy who's got a couple beagles that come. Like,
yeah.
You can increase recreational opportunities as well by edge feathering food plot edges. I mean, it's super important.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're doing this, there is no coincidence that on all the cameras we have on my family farm that the most active, well, daylight with deer is some of them that we've really edge feathered, but also nighttime pictures with rabbits.
Yep.
Is no coincidence that that's occurring on these food plots. A lot more rabbits, and I think actually we had a picture of a bobcat with a rabbit in its mouth the other day.
Yeah.
In one of these food plots that we've edge feathered. So, you know, if you're managing for rabbits, you're helping other prey species not be highly pressured by predators. Yeah, they're buffer prey.
Buffer
so
prey.
If you can basically distract your coyotes and predators with the easier meals that are much more prevalent on the landscape through rabbits and rats and mice, then you don't have to worry about them going out in your big food plots or crop field chasing your deer herd and pressuring them and stressing them out. So that's just how we handle it, and I think it
let
works
nature
well.
Run its course from there.
Yeah,
but we got to have the habitat in place.
Yeah. No, number six, diversifying the farm. So for a lot of guys that are in big timbered areas down south and the Midwest, even in the northern part,
Northeast.
There's certain
time.
Parts of your farm that you probably go from big woods to food plots or crop fields, and you don't have a lot of that old field or that young forest. And this is a great way that you can diversify the farm by adding young forest or adding old field, because let's just say you do edge feather it and you treat more of the stumps with herbicide. Not saying I probably would in many places, but you just promote forbs and grasses along the edge. You're adding things there that you wouldn't be able to find in your food plot or wouldn't allow to grow in your food plot in the first place. So you're just diversifying the farm, and that means different types of insects, different types of birds, different types of even big game possibly. So even if we go up to, you know, rough grouse, not saying it's big game, but if you've got mature trees and no young forest, it might be a little difficult to grow rough grouse on that.
There's a ton of podcasts that we've done about everything in the middle, right?
Yeah.
From if all you have from a habitat, and I'm air quoting that, I'm saying it kind of sarcastically, but literally your farm is a food plot or big timber. You have nothing in between. You have no plant communities of significance for a lot of the game that we're talking about. You literally just need it. So just
I'm trying to remember that milkweed. Was it four? I think it was four-leafed milkweed that popped up in that edge feathering project that you and I did.
Where
along
was that at?
Glady Cutoff food plot. It popped up. I think you did a video on that.
Yeah.
I think it was four-leaf milkweed.
And a lot of wild bergamot there on that edge, that same edge growing what was 2 years prior or at least a year prior, timber. Closed canopy.
Timber. Yeah.
Closed canopy timber.
Yeah.
So you never know what you're going to find.
You'd be probably pretty shocked to see what grows up. So.
Yep.
Number seven, increase the food during the summer.
Yeah.
Because just like you said, wild bergamot and A lot of times, especially if you're able to burn it at some point, where you open up that canopy, burn off that leaf litter, you're going to see a lot of forbs most likely grow up.
Ragweed,
within the first couple
ragweed,
of years,
goldenrod,
it could be
blackberry,
pokeweed being a big one.
Yep.
Or pokeberry.
Beggar's lice.
Call it.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of food that will grow there that, you know, if it's the edge of a crop field, edge of a food plot's probably not going to grow out there in the middle because you're spraying herbicide or you're doing some sort of disturbance that's limiting the amount of native forbs
or
that can grow up.
Or it may need some shade.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But you can bet there will be more food that deer will be wanting, requiring, needing along the edge, as well as the high-quality food that's growing in the food plot. So you can almost offset some of the browse pressure that would be experienced there in the food plot and divert them with all the natural food that's growing along the edge.
Yep. Number 8, turkey nesting in the spring. And I think, you know, here in Missouri, our season's kind of just past peak breeding. And so with the last 2 weeks of April, first week of May, hopefully most of the breeding is happening early or mid-April. So as season progresses, we start getting a lot more of those mid-morning hunts where hens are going to nest. And so
it's
if you've
on.
Got a beautiful food plot that's clover and then the hens are ready to go nest, it's like, well, if here's pretty good quality nesting habitat, we had it this past spring where multiple hens were nesting on our edge feathering project. So you're just increasing the amount of acres that is providing quality cover that turkeys can nest in and hopefully have a successful hatch.
Yeah, two other things on that. If the hens are nesting there, they've led gobblers off the roost to those locations, and so that's where the gobblers are going to be. They're going to be in and around those areas where the hens were. They just
hens
got going to
vanish on them, and
right?
They're going to be like, well, where'd she go?
And start gobbling. That's a great point to be able to go and either call them to or call them from those areas where that are closer to edge feathering. But then in addition, if you've improved the edge, you've improved the food plot. So the quality, whether it is alfalfa or it is a perennial clover type blend, you've got more insects growing, or not growing, but pollinating yep. in and around those areas between the edge feathering and then the blooming of those legumes. Like, you have a lot of aspects going on that is a requirement for attracting turkeys, but then brood rearing when those nests do hatch.
For sure.
A lot of things happening, but edge feathering improves that for turkeys as well.
Yep. Number 9, woody escape cover for quail. So if you are in an area that has quail, the woody escape cover is obviously crucial. If you've listened to any podcast with Kyle and Frank, you've probably heard them talk about woody escape cover and the importance of that during the fall and winter. But, you know, if you've got an edge feathered food plot, if you've got tall trees going straight in food plot or straight in crop trees, you don't have very much benefit for the quail. And so you need to edge feather. You need to cut those trees back, get that shrubby or young forest growth that's below 10 foot tall along the edge. That way you're providing something for the quail. And so if you're cutting a tree down, that structure, that tree top is now pretty good cover. And then if you've got stump sprouts popping up, then you've got, you know, trees replicating shrubs. So as long as you're managing that, you can have just an unbelievable amount of habitat or woody escape cover on those field edges or food plot edges.
Definitely.
Number 10, better mass production.
Sure. You know, we're cutting a lot of the tree species along the edge that may not be producing any value, right? The value's up in the canopy, giant tall trees, maybe it's elms, maybe it's hickories. Those are the ones that you're cutting and you're dropping down. Well, that helps to also free up maybe mass-producing trees such as red oaks, white oaks, growing along the edges of the food plot. So in addition to putting more woody browse on the ground, you're also freeing up and reducing competition around mass-producing trees. We're not saying don't cut any oaks, but oaks that don't produce or are inferior, unhealthy, absolutely cut those and involve that in your edge feathering. But ones that you know are pretty predictable as good producers, free them up, and edge feathering is a great way to be able to do that. Reduce stress around the crown of that tree, add more sunlight in, and you probably will experience a healthier tree in the years to come, therefore more mass production out of that tree by cutting additional trees and doing edge feathering.
Yeah, it wouldn't be fair if we mentioned all the positives and didn't mention some of the common negatives that people say about edge feathering. So a couple of the most common negatives you'll hear is it's not very aesthetically pleasing because it's kind of a, you know, there's trees down. Well, if you're managing your farm and fallen trees or trees down or shrubs are or young forest is not pretty to your eye, it's not a habitat issue. It's not an issue that can be fixed on the landscape. It's an issue that needs to be fixed between your ears.
It's a mindset shift. And honestly, there's a podcast. There's a gentleman I need to have on the podcast regarding that. But you have to be okay with it because you have to know that that down tree is providing all these 10 benefits.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to accept the fact that it may not be the most pretty, but it is 100% functional and increases the opportunities for your goals to come true.
Like, for sure.
You got to get, there's give and take there.
Yeah.
Has to be.
Yeah. The other big one being predator corridors. Anytime you're managing in linear shapes, you're just creating easy meals for predators. And I think a lot of times that's a little bit hard for me to grasp because basic ecology tells us that increased amount of prey species will lead to increased amount of predator species. And so anytime you're doing something on your farm that's going to benefit the prey, you should know that if it benefits the prey species so much that predators will likely follow. And so if you can get past that and go, well, why would I edge feather so I can create, you know, this habitat for turkeys and nests when coyotes now are going to find the easy meal? Well, I can assure you that if you're not doing anything to improve the nesting habitat, then you're not helping the prey species at all. So
compare and contrast that real quick. If you're not doing edge feathering, you're probably not cutting inside the timber. So adequate nesting cover just isn't really present. But where's the area where there is the most sunlight that would be coming through would be on the edge of a field where hopefully that would, you know, maybe be the most opportune area for a nest to be placed because there is half light coming through based on being along the edge. But it's not adequate as is. So a predator that they're always going to travel the edge. So then there's not great habitat. So you need to be able to, what is that?
Eurasian collared
doves. Oh, yeah, they
just
sure
letting
are.
An oak right above us.
So you need to be able to.
Non-native.
You need to be able to feather that edge so you build out the cover and give those species the ability to escape and actually hide in good quality cover. Still knowing, regardless, it's an edge, predators are going to be moving along the edge. Give them what they need. Know that with proper escape cover, as a prey, they will survive.
Yeah.
Or higher percentage will survive.
Don't be a deadbeat land manager. Get out and edge feather.
Yeah.
Get out and put in some young forest. I think that's one of the things, too, that as land managers, we try to pride ourselves on all the things that we've done. You see it a lot in social media. Where it's like, oh, I did all this work to harvest this deer. I put out this, or I did this. A lot of times, you don't ever see edge feathering listed.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So from now on, hopefully, you guys are listening. If you stuck around with us this long, you're going to be motivated to do some edge feathering. And you can be like, man, I'm doing edge feathering. I'm doing young forest creation. I'm invasive species removal. I'm prairie restoration. Man, you're doing something for the deer that even people that may not be into hunting can get behind and support because you're managing the land the way it was intended. So,
totally.
Guys, we thank you so much for listening this week.
We have some exciting stuff coming.
Yeah.
So be listening for the next couple weeks of podcast. We'll be releasing some fun new opportunities with Land and Legacy that you guys want to be a part of, or we hope. So be watching, listening on all channels. We appreciate you guys listening and following along. We'll catch you next week.
Yeah.